I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground. In the week of COP15, the UN's Conference on Life Itself, Biodiversity, which was supposed to be in China, the issue of food security has only just been debated here in Dubai, where I'm speaking to you from. And its urgency was underlined this week by farmers' unions in a Britain sending billions of dollars of weapons to Ukraine, warning that even the UK is sleepwalking into a food supply crisis. All this as NATO nations blame Russia for hundreds of millions across the global south going hungry this Christmas. Who or what is to blame then? Is it, as the UN claims, humanity's war with nature? Leading the UN Committee on World Food Security up until a few weeks ago was Chris Hegedorn. He joins me from France's capital, Paris. Thank you so much, Chris, for coming on. I better first just start asking you what the World Food Security Committee actually is. Some people might not know it was set up all the way back in 1974.
Well, let me clarify, I was the secretary for 3.5 years up until the end of October. And the committee indeed was set up in 74 in a context of a global food crisis. That was back in the days when there was a massive famine in East Pakistan, now Bangladesh. And the global community felt a multilateral setting, such as the CFS, would be a way for countries to come together to address and resolve crises. It's done its job helping countries and experts to play their part in addressing changing food security issues. It was reformed in 2009 at the height of another crisis. And so it's a very different institution than it was when it started, bringing a expert scientific panel into the process, bringing all three of the Rome UN agencies together in one platform, and enjoining the UN members with the experts all around the UN system, the civil society, private sector, the Bretton Woods institutions like the World Bank, and everyone is part of that conversation to address policy convergence within the CFS.
I mean, I don't want to be too mean, obviously, Chris, but even before the wheat basket of Europe, Ukraine, facing what it is right now, we have 828 million hungry this Christmas. I'm not blaming it all on you. Obviously, it's all those stakeholders that have a part to play. Why is the World Food Security Committee failing? Why is it such a failure? We know there's enough food to feed the earth, what, three times over, and it's not a supply problem per se. Why are all these people facing starvation this Christmas?
Yeah, well, it's exactly a big problem. And those numbers which you cited, which come from the SOFI 2022 report, actually refer to the previous year. So I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers are even higher. FAO just came out with a report in early December saying 45 countries are in urgent need of food assistance, 33 of them in Africa, all reeling with the issues of climate, of COVID-19, soaring inflation, and of course, the major driver, the conflicts which are going on around the world, including the one you cited between Russia and Ukraine.
I mean, there are 4 million children in poverty in Britain, but I mean, that can't be the problem, COVID and all these other things, can it? I mean,
of course it is. It's part of it. Airdropping food is extremely expensive. You know the WFP well. I know from other interviews you've had, you're very aware of what the situation is and who the players are. This is extremely complex. It's issue, first of all, no one can even agree on exactly how to solve world hunger. We have targets in SDG 2, but it's extremely complex. And the conflicts in particular, which just seem to be expanding, are really tipping the balance. The invasion of Ukraine in February of this past year, of course, was the invasion of a country that is one of the major breadbaskets of the world for wheat, for grains, for sunflower oil.
One question I have to ask is, the greatest successful food security provision, perhaps in all world history, was performed by the Chinese Communist Party, 800 million out of poverty, of course, and feeding 800 million in a space of a couple of decades, 75% of global poverty reduction in 40 years. Do you notice that there's something different about the way the Chinese Communist Party operate, or the party in Cuba, I suppose, which is sanctioned? they don't involve private stakeholders or private actors. Did your time at the Committee on World Food Security take on board that the most successful food security operation can be made by copying, perhaps, the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, it's actually my experience before the CFS. When I was a diplomat living in China, I got firsthand to witness the way the Chinese work. And if you go back to the late 70s, after the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping introduced market reforms, which actually did put private sector and the profit motive into play, which is what helped drive China's rather remarkable experience in bringing that many people out of poverty. So yes, China is a member of the CFS. China is active in the FAO, as you know. In fact, the director general of the FAO is Chinese. So their experience does bear on everything from research and science to the way the global system and trade works.
Don't tell Joe Biden that, clearly, because you get the fun. I mean, you were at UNESCO as well. You saw how that the money dried up on that one. Obviously, the kind of private sector increased involvement in the market reforms in China are very different to the private stakeholders today in global food security in Western nations, though. What is the power of... we're interviewing Dr. Vandana Shiva, the pioneer of one of the pioneers of anti-globalization on the show in a week or so's time on this show. I mean, she's been saying it is these private corporate stakeholders that big international institutions mix up with, very different, arguably, to the small stakeholders that China was favoring in their agricultural revolution. It's their fault. That's why there's all these hundreds of millions that are starving this Christmas. It's not Ukraine. It's not COVID. It's actually something much more systemic if we have enough food in the world. And it's the drive for profit from, say, fertilizer companies that's really causing the starvation.
Well, I suspect you'd want to talk to a Nobel Prize-winning economist who can tell you more about the macroeconomics on this one. But the point is, China does engage in the global trade market. It is heavily dependent on imports of certain feed products for meat production. It exports a lot. So to differentiate China between the rest of the trading system, I would look at the issues that COVID did unveil. I think in the global supply of food is quite revealing, particularly the concentration in the hands of a few small number of companies, trading companies, in the ways that agriculture trading is done, the shipping, the insurance, everything involved, including for fertilizer and key inputs into agriculture.
Well, they're hugely state-controlled, right? I mean, okay, perhaps we're talking too
in
much
China,
about China.
Course,
I mean, Eritrea, say. Pick Eritrea, 100% food security, sanctioned by the United States and European governments. Take Cuba, sanctioned by the United States. Why is it these countries that are outside the economic system do so well on food security? Take Eritrea. I mean, you must have passed your desk at the Committee for World Food Security.
No, Eritrea is not one that I've dealt with very often. They weren't active in CFS, but I do know and read as much as I can on the region. It is a particularly vulnerable country, particularly with what we're seeing as a result of climate change. Now, I know you're interested in sanctions issues and the politics around that. But the fact of the matter is a much larger number of people are suffering and impacted by climate change, and we're not addressing it in the way it needs to be addressed, either in the UN Framework Convention, the COPs, last one held not far from Eritrea in Sharm el-Sheikh. We have to take it seriously. The continued use of fossil fuels at the base of our agricultural systems is leaving us very vulnerable. You see in the Horn of Africa, droughts that are putting millions at risk, the locust infestations, all the changes that are manifested in this type of
I mean, as you know, but I mean, Britain has just announced a massive trade deal with the United States to start importing LNG gas from fracked areas of Louisiana and who knows where else in the United States as fracking. And I think we can both agree that's probably not good for climate change. That's kind of over, isn't it? I mean, that kind of, I mean, talk. I mean, it's there's lots of talk about it at conferences. Again, one of the biggest images, China is saying solar power, mass solar, and so on, and all these different breakthroughs. Western nations, they don't seem to be that bothered about fossil fuels anymore after what happened in Ukraine, do they?
No, I think there is a recognition. I think more has to be done. But I think there are very clear commitments that have been made. The U.S. is back in the Paris Accord. There is a framework in mind to get to net zero from the energy sector for its, you know, the largest contribution to greenhouse gases. But I think there has to be a realization and the investment to go with it that fossil fuel consumption is not the way forward. We have to stop. And in the recovery from COVID, you see this huge boost in energy consumption, including in coal and other fossil fuels. We have to incentivize renewables in a much stronger way.
Everyone kind of agrees with all of that. And of course, critics on both sides say there are vested interests in the green movement who are not doing what they're saying and so forth. But on global food security, your central role as a secretary of the committee with the FAO, a UN committee, I think many of our viewers may want to know, and I asked Agnes Kalibata this, the UN Special Envoy. She acknowledged that there were problems with neoliberal models of the way systems worked when it came to food. Have you personally experienced lobbying of any kind when you were at the UN World Food Security Committee?
Of course, it's the UN is a political body, so lobbying goes on everywhere, including at the CFS. And the CFS is a committee that is hosted at the FAO, but it's a multilateral body with 133 members. It's again, it's decisions are made by the members, but it relies on the technical expertise of FAO, EFAD, and WFP. So lobbying is going on because every country, every region has its views on their own domestic interests, their own
private lobbying.
Well, the private sector is part of a CFS. So, of course, there is a private sector representation, just like there is a civil society group.
Chris Hagedorn, I'll stop you there. More from the former secretary of the UN Committee on World Food Security after this break.
Got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Well, Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former secretary of the UN Committee on World Food Security, Chris Hagedorn. On private lobbying, how does it work at these big, international level discussions? Does someone put a can of Roundup on the table and say, here's this for your garden? Because these are pretty powerful companies that you're dealing with and their lobbyists.
Right. Well, let me emphasize, was dealing with, because I'm no longer the secretary. But the again, the point of CFS is that it is a big tent that brings in everyone. And Rome, of course, is the center for food issues within the UN. So you have an active participation of scientists, of diplomats, of private sector, civil society groups, everybody who has a stake in this game. Now, we developed policy recommendations on the topic of innovations, and this we wound up changing the name to innovative approaches, agroecological and other innovative approaches, because there's an ongoing debate about whether agroecology is the way forward or more industrial types of food production. And so that's the type of political debate that's going on all the time, including at the CFS. And
what's your view?
My view is that I think there's plenty of room for agroecological approaches, using technology, using science and research, and using better data. Data systems are notoriously weak, particularly in the countries that are most food insecure. So if you can link data to policy making, so people actually are making decisions based on the facts, yeah, this is a very good thing. So I think there is much room for a move towards regenerative agriculture. There's plenty of data out there. Companies that are collecting data into satellite data, others.
But which companies?
Well, there's the Googles and the various folks who are using satellite data for everything from traffic to tracking your food purchases. But it's data that will help countries stick to a strategy to use agriculture to get out of poverty. And this is the way we see data systems and the importance of data being tied to policy. So governments and policymakers are actually making informed decisions.
You mentioned Google there. I mean, some would say, especially those who are lobbying in a very different direction, who don't believe that these two segments of food security can coexist, would say, no, forget Google, forget Bayer and Corteva, I understand, is the company that came through from Dow. Forget these companies. Small holding farms produce more food. In fact, I gave you Eritrea as an example earlier. That's what you do. You have small holdings and you don't industrialize farming, which some say creates health risks, the prevalence of allergies, all sorts of different problems associated with mechanized industrial production. And that, in fact, the fact that they can produce enough food anyway, we don't need this industrialization. Actually, what you're saying is symptomatic of a desire for profit and shareholder value on Wall Street, far more than feeding these hundreds of millions that will starve in the next few days.
Well, your words, not mine, but I understand where you're trying to find the story here. It's a transition. They have to coexist. There are different models and there are different ways of doing business, whether it's the United States or Cambodia or some other smaller developing country that doesn't have the same access to resources that in the global markets. The market and the trading system is not going to go away, and it has to be respected for the most efficient allocation of resources. The question is, how does the trading system improve? And this is what I'd like to see the WTO doing a better job in addressing these inequalities, the lack of resilience in the trading system that COVID unveiled, and address the issue of subsidies.
How do you mean the WTO, in terms of protecting intellectual property rights for seeds or reducing protectionism in the European Union? Many members of the Global South.
Yeah, no, I understand the criticisms and I understand where it can do better. The fact of the matter is the forum where the rules are made and applied and disputes are resolved. What I think is important, one of the most important things for the WTO to do is to make sure that export restrictions are avoided at all costs, certainly those that are not within the rules. You know, there were upwards of 39 export restrictions as late as August of this year. I think the number has gone down since, but those are what most people describe as the root cause of the crisis back in 2009, when countries slapped export restrictions on rice. So following rules, strengthening those rules, and putting teeth in the system when those rules are broken, I think is something that the WTO can look at very squarely, and I think they are.
I know the WTO opposes or appears to, it has to play a very diplomatic sidestep dance on this, opposes a lot of US sanctions. I don't know how many countries the United States sanctions right now. Incalculable, obviously, China and other countries when it comes to industry. I'm sure that breaks WTO rules. But are US sanctions actually a force for good in that they make individual economies that I mentioned earlier sustainable and better able to create food security in those countries? The Bolivian president was on this show. He intimated that. Obviously, as I said, Cuba, people in Nicaragua, you name it. Every country in the world that has been hugely sanctioned by the United States and NATO nations usually creates food security by being outside of this global mechanism and trade mechanism, which makes them over-reliant on a few corporations.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, this is obviously an extremely complex topic. There are rules, and when the rules aren't followed, there has to be some system in place to make people follow the rule book. Look, if there's, I think, a mischaracterization of what sanctions, how they're applied, how they're enforced. Economic sanctions obviously are a key tool in economic statecraft, but typically food and medicines are exempt from sanctions regimes. It's the same for Russia and Ukraine. It's the same for Cuba. And I know there's a lot of complexity beyond that general statement, but typically food is not on the list of sanctionable items.
In Iraq, the sanctions against Saddam Hussein that preceded the war, and how many
we spent a year there.
How many were killed? And you know how Venezuela blamed sanctions for impoverishing, and one estimate had 21,000 dead, is it, from sanctions? I know you speak with a great deal of authority because, of course, you were a diplomat previously. Alas, you're not that close to Joe Biden, but you did work as an intern there, and you were his assistant. Tell me what you expect from Joe Biden on world food security, given that the world is facing such a terrible threat this Christmas?
Yeah, well, I did work for then Senator Biden on my first job in Washington before going off to grad school, and have a lot of respect for him, his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, and the staff that I worked with, who were absolutely top notch. I know he has really his head and heart in the right place when it comes to dealing with the world's problems, especially the conflicts that are going on around the world that are causing so much of the food insecurity. So I think, the first response was addressing COVID, the loss of life, massive loss of life in the United States, and trying to help deliver vaccines around the world. And then domestic issues about how to address food insecurity in the U.S. I know you're aware of the kind of numbers, which are fairly surprising and upsetting in the U.S., the number of people who are on either economic assistance or lining up at soup kitchens. So these are things that hit home for Americans as well as those around the world.
One segment of the pro-Democrat camp who believe that he's completely out of touch and funded by credit card companies in Delaware, high finance, and he doesn't care.
No, I don't. every politician has his critics. I don't see that the criticism is valid. I think Biden administration is doing its best to not only take care of American farmers, and change the dynamic. If you look at a political map of who votes for whom in the U.S., you look at the red states, those are the ones where our food is grown. I think Mr. Biden and his agriculture secretary understand that you have to win the hearts and minds of farmers to continue to be elected.
How do conferences really, I mean, given COP15 is on, given I know there's a conference today where you're speaking with the head of the WHO, how do they help food security? I mean, you know, it would be unkind, wouldn't it, to say if only the poor could eat conferences. But do you enjoy them? Because the kinds of people that go to these conferences is more often than not the poorest people, are there?
You're right in that regard, but I think these conferences do bring people together who can bring different perspectives and experiences. Having the Director General of the WHO speak on a conference panel looking at food security makes it very clear that those two issues, food security and nutrition, are inseparable, right? The number one killer in the world is diet-related disease. We're talking about heart failure, diabetes, cancers, people dying of early deaths because of the foods they eat, ultra-processed foods, sugar, fats, the salts.
Do you eat organic food?
I do. Yep, I make a point of it.
You buy pesticide-free, GMO-free food?
Whenever I can.
Well,
I'm willing to pay a little extra to avoid the risk of the what ifs. I would much rather eat locally grown, healthy, organic food in season.
You know that the big companies that go to the conferences that we just talked about, they say that they're safe. I mean, Bill Gates, I know the Bill and Melinda Gates Corporation fund a lot of these things. Gates said, I've never been shy about my passion for fertilizer. It's a magical innovation that's responsible for saving millions of lives from hunger, lifting millions out of poverty. What are you doing eating food that hasn't been given chemical fertilizer?
Listen, Mother Nature does it right. It's the best way to grow food. In my opinion, yes, we've been able to use scientific advances to increase the yields of certain plants, rice plants, wheat plants, you name it. It's impressive, but has it resolved the hunger issue? The answer is no. I think if we get back to the basics of letting Mother Nature do what she does best, which is balancing out the pests and the fungi and the diseases with our human bodies and the human biome, I think we will all be better off. Now, population is running very high. Population increases. And this is something that is not talked about very often. But what's better, seeing people starve or feeding them with food that is produced with chemical fertilizers? I'd have to say I'd rather see people eating GMO industrial produced food than starve to death. But we have big issues to resolve on this score.
Well, the companies all say that it's completely safe to eat their fertilizer food, all the big chemical companies, and some people say that it's not a choice at all because there's enough food. But Chris Hagedorn, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back next week with another brand new episode. But until then, you can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. But you can always head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.